You want answers?
I think I'm entitled to.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth! Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulis. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulis.
Okay, well, welcome to the latest episode of the Security Perimeter Podcast. And today's guest is Inigo Guevara, who is an expert on defense issues, particularly speaking, an expert on defense issues in Mexico. Inigo is a Mexican by origin. He studied at the Tec de Monterrey, did a degree in business, international business, then went on to Georgetown to do a master's degree in international security. From then, he's worked at a number of different places, but right now, he's at Jane's Security and Consultancy, which provides services to both governments and firms. Inigo, thank you for being on the Security Perimeter Podcast. It's really an honor to have you here. You've been studying Mexican defense issues for at least a decade and a half. Thank you, Inigo, for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you so much, Saki, for the invitation. I'm honored to be on the Security Perimeter Podcast, and looking forward to see how I can contribute.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, as you know, the topic is the Mexican Army. We'll be focusing specifically on SEDENA, the Secretaría de Defensa Nacional. For those non-Spanish speakers, SEDENA, the Secretaría de Defensa Nacional, is the National Defense Secretariat, which is essentially the Army and the Air Force, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Inigo?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Mexico's defense structure is significantly atypical from that of the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So, I'm looking forward to talking about it because it's got a lot of history in it, and we can really explain why it's the way it is.
Yeah, the one thing that I'm going to want to try to understand is why is there this separation between the Navy and the Army? To the point where they literally have two different secretariats, and which is, like you said, unique and I think almost completely unique in the world. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you a question that a lot of the people out there listening are going to have, because most of them are from the United States. How does SEDENA differ as far as a Ministry of Defense is concerned from the U.S. Department of Defense?
Well, the first striking difference is that it's the cabinet level secretary is a senior military officer. Mm-hmm. So he's the only 4-star general.
In the case of Mexico, right?
In the case of Mexico, yeah. He's an active duty army general, and who functions both as commander of the army as well as secretary of defense.
Okay.
So he has both operational and political.
Yeah, I mean, he has political functions, right? I mean, he's a member of the cabinet.
Yes.
Okay, would that be, in as far as you're concerned, the biggest difference? If it is, there's some things I wanted to ask you about that specifically, but, I mean, are there differences in the way command structures work compared to U.S. defense, or in terms of, I imagine there's differences in terms of training, of course, but any other significant difference that you can think of between the two?
Yes, definitely. The other big difference is that there's not a Joint Chief of Staff organization.
Ah, yeah.
So there's, everything that has to do with jointness, while the U.S. is probably the most jointest force in the world.
Right.
In the case of Mexico, we have SEMAR and SEDENA pretty much functioning as two very different and independent armed forces.
Okay. Well, the immediate question that comes to mind then is how the heck does that work?
Yeah. Well, so far, what we've seen is a differentiation of tasks.
Okay.
And that has been up to around 2007. It was very clear in that the Ministry of the Navy or the Secretary of the Navy would function on the coasts and, of course, at sea.
Yeah.
While the Army and the Air Force, their area of responsibility was very clear.
Yeah.
So we had a very clear difference in where they acted and how they acted.
So the roles that the missions they actually had solved the issue of the fact that there wasn't a Joint Chief of Staff.
Exactly.
Okay.
It was irrelevant. And at that point, we see that the armed forces today are pretty much, the structure, the political structure of the armed forces, not the armed forces themselves, are a product from the Mexican Revolution, basically, from the PRIs,
yeah.
Divide and conquer, if we could call it that, or basically separate so that not one single ministry would have all of the power, all of the might of the armed forces. And after the revolution, okay, there was a single ministry,
right,
which was the Ministry of War and Navy.
Okay.
And they were headed by an active duty army general.
Oh.
And the idea, the original idea, was that it would rotate. But there weren't any notable admirals during the revolution.
Okay.
Right. So basically, the generals maintained control. So this was a product of the separation. Was a product of during World War II.
Ah, okay. That late, huh?
That late, exactly. Yeah. World War II, 1941. The president instructs the Navy to become a department, and then to become its own. 1940 to become a department, and 1941. To become its own cabinet level position because of the need to significantly strengthen Mexico's naval defense capabilities.
I see.
So at the time, it was a reaction that one, it would allow the admirals to have a direct line to the president. It would allow funding resources to be channeled directly to the Ministry of the Navy or directly through to the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way to manage a crisis.
What do you mean? Which crisis?
The World War II.
Ah, okay.
So,
okay.
But that didn't change after World War II. The
right.
Political class saw that there was a benefit in keeping the forces separated.
All right.
Remember that up to then, Mexico had been governed by usually a military politician.
Right.
So they saw that someone being in control of the military,
yeah,
was a political rival that could eventually topple them.
Okay.
So that became the main political reason to maintain the forces separate.
Okay, so to weaken them.
to not to weaken them, to separate them, and to manage them better, because that way, at that point, it frankly made sense once we hear the context of it.
Okay.
But once we fast forward, we see that the new generation of civilian politicians, which started with Aleman,
right,
really one didn't want to get involved with the military.
Right.
So they wanted to maintain a status quo of having the military, like you said, divided, and therefore not as strong, and therefore not a threat. Remember that military coups throughout Latin America during the 50s, during the 60s, during the 70s,
yeah,
were a dime a dozen.
Right, right.
So this was a formula that the political class eventually evolved so that they could maintain both the armed forces pretty much separate.
That's interesting, Inigo. I hadn't realized that there were political reasons behind the separation. I thought there was, like you said, some kind of military logic to it, like you explained with respect to the First World War. But afterwards, it seemed to serve the political class, and it kind of leads me to, I guess, the last question for this section or for this segment, which is, do you still think there's a need for the separation politically? And secondly, is this separation, as far as capacity to respond to threats, is it a weakness, or has Sedena and Marina been able to overcome the fact that, well, they're separate entities?
I think they've brought the come to overcome that fact. Come to overcome the and understand that they need to work together.
But isn't there rivalry? Isn't there? My understanding is that there's some considerable rivalry between the two ministries.
Yes, but there, when we look at every other country's military, there's significant rivalry within the branches or competition, because there's always going to be competition for resources. So that's normal when we look at the U.S. Yes. armed forces.
The fact that we don't have a joint chief doesn't affect the ability of the country to respond to threats.
No. And also because the threat level has never reached the same level that it had during World War II.
Okay.
So if Mexican institutions are usually in response, like most countries' institutions, are mostly a response to how you manage the country and to how to manage a threat.
Right.
Right, so if it came to a point that Mexico was threatened territorially, it would immediately need to reorganize in order to cope to that threat.
All right. So sorry. Go ahead. Can you sort of repeat the thought?
Sure. A bit. So Mexican institutions, like most countries' institutions, right? We look at the creation of DHS. That was a reaction to a very, very large failure. So it's an institutional reaction to that. So if Mexico was faced with a significant threat, I'm very sure, and the answer to that threat was to streamline the armed forces and create some sort of a joint response.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that could be done significantly swiftly.
Oh, okay.
Now,
yeah,
something else that tells us that's pretty keen is that it's not that these armed forces haven't joined because they don't want to or because they're resistant to it.
Yeah.
Of course they're resistant to it. But at the end of the day, organizing or reorganizing the cabinet, as we saw during this sexenio, with the reorganization of the Secretaría de Seguridad Pública, that's the public safety,
right,
public security ministry that existed during the past two administrations. If a new president came in and wanted to reorganize the cabinet and create a single ministry,
mm-hmm.
that could pretty much be done by a presidential decree.
The issue of a military officer playing, at least implicitly, some kind of political role within the context of the cabinet. How do you see that? How do you view that? Because again, Mexico is almost unique in that respect as well, in having a, yeah. a serving officer as Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, yeah, no. I mean, I understand. I've studied completely the every single type of option we can put together, and the standard Western NATO doctrine of having a civilian in charge of the defense apparatus, and of course a military officer in charge of the military forces.
Right.
That's a structure that makes sense in the rest of the world, definitely.
Yeah.
In the case of Mexico, I have to say that I'm not completely convinced that's the case.
Okay. Why is
sadly,
that?
I think that the Mexican political class is not mature enough to handle a serious institution like the military.
Mm-hmm.
So far, while we can say everything that it goes against Western doctrine, that the Mexican military is led at the political level by an active duty officer.
Right.
At the same time, we have the fact that the Mexican armed forces are the most trusted institutions to Mexican society.
To a lesser extent, in the last few years, with the human rights issues and so forth, right? I mean, yes, looking 15 years ago, that was definitely the case. But in the last 3 or 4 years, they've lost some points, haven't they?
I believe they lost some points around between 2008 and 2011.
Mm.
And then it kick-started back up because, and this is something I've told a room full of Mexican military, senior Mexican military officers, when I tell them that, well, you know, both Sedena and Samar hold the second and first places in institutional trust by Mexicans.
Yeah.
And they all smile, and I tell them, but that's a tragedy.
Sure.
Because the police should occupy that. So the worst rated functions of government are usually Congress and transit police.
Okay.
Everyone hates both of them.
And the tax department, I bet, too.
And probably the tax. Yes. Probably the Satan, the IRS.
The IRS in the US, yeah. Yes. Okay. And sat in Mexico. You know, that's probably the most sophisticated response that I've heard with respect to why there shouldn't be a civilian at the head of the ministry, the defense ministry. I'll tell you why I say that, because most people tend to respond by, well, there's nobody out there that's been trained on these kinds of issues, that knows these issues. And you know, the standard response to that is that, well, there's a lot of countries that have ministers of defense or secretaries of the defense that high school teachers, look at the minister of defense in Germany, for example, a woman with absolutely no background in the military. But your response was a little bit different, maybe a little bit more nuanced, and I'd like you to maybe take it a little bit further. What do you mean by that?
By that, I mean, yes, of course, I think, you know, and you said the context pretty well and the comparative pretty well when you talk about other countries' defense secretaries. But unfortunately, we don't have a German style of professional career service civil servants. Institutions in Mexico.
We don't want to have, or we don't have?
We don't have.
Yeah.
In Mexico, we don't have a professional civil service career class.
Okay.
The only professional career officers, if we could call them that, are the military and the foreign service.
Yeah. So I mean, so you're saying you basically just don't trust the Mexican political class? I mean, is that fair to say that?
Yes, completely.
Okay.
And usually when someone's appointed to head a department or a ministry, that person comes in and he gets to choose his chief of staff.
Right.
and he gets to choose probably his private secretary.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Yeah.
You know, then they need to choose whoever has been working there for the past 20 or 30 years to become their board of directors, right?
Right.
And that doesn't happen in Mexico.
Yeah, okay. Let's focus a little bit more about Sedena, because we do have another session on Marina. How big is Sedena? Can you just give us some numbers here? Sure. What are we talking about in terms of troops? Numbers.
Sure. Definitely. Thank you. That's my bread and butter.
Okay.
So Sedena is the largest by far of the security and defense ministries. And Sedena is about 215,000 to 220,000 personnel.
Active, or does that include reserve? And
there's not a reserve system. There's a theoretical reserve system in Mexico, which means that everyone up to age 40, 18 from 18 to age 40 constitutes a theoretical reserve.
Okay, so these 200 are active duty.
They're active duty. They're professional.
Yeah.
That means that they're not conscripted. They're not drafted.
Okay.
They are volunteers. And that's probably one of the largest armed forces in Latin America. And I would say, I'm thinking that it's even larger than the Colombian army.
Yeah.
At this point, because or the Brazilian one, because both of those have a heavy emphasis on conscription.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the largest professional all volunteer force in Latin America.
Okay,
right. It's about three times as big as the Canadian Armed Forces.
I think maybe even a little bit bigger. Go ahead. Yeah.
That said, they function mostly with an internal security role, right? So, so the Mexican army is organized into battalions and battalion level units, which are called regiments. But that is the name that artillery and armor.
Mm-hmm.
And cavalry units receive. They're called regiments, and everything else is called a battalion.
Okay.
So the battalion is a standard operating force. It's a standard battalion size. It's 680 something. It's just that the artillery and the cavalry and the armor units are called regiments.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's all right. Okay.
So it's pretty easy to figure it out when it's a battalion, when it's a regiment.
Okay.
It's somehow the same type of unit. Artillery units are a little bit weaker. Well, not weaker, less. You know, they have about 450 to 500 troops, simply because they have a different doctrine and a different type of equipment and a different mission.
Okay.
Infantry battalions are the main unit deployed throughout Mexico. And in recent, let's say the past 20 years or so, there's been a drive towards creating a brigade type of structure. They've shifted towards creating a brigade.
So it's a relatively new thing then.
It's a relatively new thing, and it's been received lukewarm, basically.
How come?
Sometimes, because usually there's not a need to deploy an entire brigade, and they've found it easier to deploy infantry battalions. And I'm talking about internal deployments.
The internal mission, yeah.
For the internal mission.
Yeah, okay.
But the brigade structure does exist. In most cases, it functions basically on paper.
Okay. What about capability, training, and also equipment. How does that stand up?
Yes. So capability, training, and equipment. Training, there's several number of schools. There's upwards of 20 specialization schools. Training has been doubled down over the past 10 years or so. So training has improved significantly. Mm-hmm. And most of the training has focused on small unit operations. So the Mexican Army does maintain, you know, at the doctrinal level, a combined arms and conventional type of operation, which is what makes an army an army.
Okay.
That means military fighting.
Yeah.
But most of the specialized training has been done towards small unit operations.
I see.
And that is pretty much what's been taking place in the U.S. as well.
Right, right.
Over the past 20 years or so, the U.S. has shifted towards small unit operations. And it's not that Mexico is following the U.S., It's simply that warfare has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Warfare has evolved from the end of the Cold War, when we had large tank armies and supported by field artillery and very large air force with ground attack aircraft, etc., learning to fight together, to small units interacting with technology mostly. In order and advancing pretty much in parallel, and that's what we've seen throughout the Middle East recently as well.
Right.
So, in the case of Mexico, most of the training has been done starting from 2007. The new doctrine was on how to come in and implement security cordons around small cities.
I see. Okay.
And how to conduct urban operations.
Urban operations.
So that is the most dramatic shift is that since 2007,
right,
the military began to conduct urban operations because they had been fighting a war against cartels and a war against drugs pretty much since the early 1960s.
Okay.
But the shift has been in the past 10 years towards fighting these not just in the countryside, but going into the cities because the cartels moved into the cities.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's been basically what they've been doing.
Okay. So what about... I'm sorry. Go ahead, Inigo.
So, you know, armies are basically made up of three main branches. Infantry, cavalry, or armor, and artillery. In the case of Mexico, the infantry is significantly on par with its several Western counterparts. They have the weapons they need. They have the training they need. We see engagements where the Mexican military is significantly superior to most rivals that it faces.
Okay.
And then when it comes to artillery and on armor, we see something completely different.
Okay.
In the case of the artillery, since it hasn't been used against cartels, because it doesn't require that type of a response, artillery has been pretty much left in the dark over the past 40 or 50 years.
Okay.
So Mexican artillery units have slowly begun to implement technological updates to most of their howitzers. But most of their howitzers are either from the 1950s,
mm-hmm,
or the newest ones are from the early 1980s.
I see. What about armor?
In the case of armor, most of the, what we would call, there's really not any type of heavy armor.
Yes.
There's no main battle tanks. Mexico has absolutely no tanks. The last tanks Mexico operated were some stored tanks during World War II.
Yeah.
So, and the last time that Mexico began to develop a requirements for tanks, which was the late 1970s, when doctrine basically modernized to be for the Mexican Armed Forces, and that's when they got enough funding for the Mexican Armed Forces hardware to modernize. They had initially selected the M60 tank, which was an American tank.
Mm-hmm.
But tests proved that the M60s, if they were to be used in southeastern Mexico, it would have been a logistical nightmare. Because first of all, the bridges couldn't hold them. So okay. There was absolutely no strategic sense in using tanks.
Okay.
In requiring tanks. Whether that's going to change in the next few years as Mexican peacekeeping operations may take on a different shift towards maybe even forming part of an international task force or something. Well, that's pretty. We'll have to see what happens in the future for that.
Okay.
So most of Mexico's armor was selected from looking at what the French were doing in Africa. So the French in the late 1970s were using these wheeled 6x6 armored reconnaissance vehicles,
mm-hmm.
which had a 90 millimeter cannon, which was pretty much enough to stop anything that came in their way, but they're not really tanks.
Yeah.
And we've seen them, in the parades in Mexico since the 1980s.
Okay.
And they've been the same type of armored vehicles.
Okay.
The only real change happened in the 1990s when Mexico set up 10 mechanized infantry battalions.
Okay.
With armored personnel carriers procured from France and Belgium, which were from the basically 1950s vintage APCs.
Mm-hmm.
And someone in the Mexican Armed Forces thought it'd be a good idea to get these tanks, which were very high quality for the time, and completely re-engineered them,
mm-hmm.
to use all their parts, so update them with night vision systems, etc. But at the end of the day, you know, it's like if you have a pimped up 1950s Chevy.
Okay.
At the end of the day, it's still a 1950s Chevy.
Right.
Right.
So
as we're moving forward, it's time for the Mexican Army to definitely replace those.
I heard the Mexican Army is in the market for new APCs. Have you heard that too? And do you know what which one in particular has caused some interest?
I know that they've been looking at a new family of armored vehicles, definitely. And there's a project out there which should be open source. That calls for a new family of, I think they're looking at a 6x6,
mm-hmm.
and maybe pretty much like the Brazilians did, looking at using a 6x6 for most of their needs, but then being able to have sort of like a bigger cousin with an 8x8,
mm-hmm.
That has a stronger turret. I think they've been considering the Striker.
You know, I love that one, right?
Which is, it's my favorite too.
Yeah.
The Striker is definitely under consideration, built in Canada.
Yes, sir.
But I'm not I'm not sure at this point that they will get the funding to start that.
Okay, how do you see the Air Force?
The Air Force has been modernizing over the past decade. And they modernized significantly, but they're still a very small air force.
Mm-hmm.
There's still an air force that is mostly geared towards securing Mexico's airspace from illegal aircraft, these illegal, mostly being drug carrying.
Right, yeah.
Cessnas.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much like an air force that's prepared for a very low intensity conflict or a very low threat.
Okay.
There's one squadron of supersonic fighters, which is at this moment depleted significantly.
Yeah. Are you talking about the aircraft? The F-5?
The F-5s. Yeah, that's the 402nd squadron.
Yeah.
And the F-5s have been, now I think that they're at a 3 or 4 flyable F-5s.
Okay.
Most of their engines had to go, basically, because they were at the end of their service lives. The problem is what to do with the F-5s, because the F-5 is a fantastic little aircraft.
Yes.
It's easy to maintain. It's very rugged. We've seen air forces around the world trying to maintain and hold on to their F-5s,
mm-hmm.
because they're cheap to operate. They're cheap to own.
Mm-hmm.
They're very high performance.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember the F-5s, I mean, the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Navy still holds on to their F-5s because they're the best aggressor trainers.
Mm-hmm.
They're fast, they're nimble.
Yeah,
they're flexible.
Does Mexico even need supersonic fighters or interceptors like the F-5?
I think Mexico needs to have at least a very token capability, because you never know. You know, of course, the threat is not imminent, but you never know when you are going to need to have that capability. And frankly, investing in a squadron or two squadrons of supersonic fighters is at the very lowest cost-wise for a nation this size.
Is that on the table to modernize the supersonic flight capabilities of the country? Or
at this point, the idea is to recover the F-5s.
Mm-hmm.
And Mexico has gone a very different way than other countries, in that they've chosen to upgrade them basically piecemeal by having the engines upgraded by one supplier, having the systems, the onboard systems upgraded by a different supplier. Mm-hmm. So they're basically outsourcing an upgrade capability to multiple suppliers instead of selecting a single project manager,
okay,
which has been the case in countries like Brazil,
okay,
in countries like Singapore, in countries like Korea that maintain their F-5s.
Okay, we're almost running out of time, but I do have a couple of more questions. Let me ask you this one, which I think people are going to be interested in. How has the fight against the cartels impacted Sedena?
That has been a significant impact over the past 10 years. I mean, Sedena has been fighting cartels, like we mentioned, since the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But going into the cities to fight them, to hunt them, has been a significant drain on the army.
Okay.
Mainly on the army.
Right.
And I think that's what, you know, when Secretary Cienfuegos comes out and says the armed forces are drained, they're exhausted.
Yeah.
By doing this, I think that's a clear message to the finance ministry.
I see.
Because there's an obvious disconnect between the amount of roles and missions that Sedena is in charge of with the amount of funding.
That's a question I wanted to ask you before, and I forgot. Budget speaking, Mexico is really down there.
Oh, yes, completely. Mexico spends about on a good year, 0.6% of its GDP That's how we usually measure and compare armed forces, because yeah. using nominal currencies not an option. So
it works out to what, about 10, 15 billion a year?
No, much less. It's about 7
billion a year. That's quite low.
7 billion, and now with the recent exchange rate,
even lower. It's quite low. Okay, so
the only other country mm-hmm. in Latin America that spends less is Guatemala,
mm-hmm.
and they spend by law 0.49% of GDP.
Okay, you were saying that the minister, the secretary rather, was sending a message to finance that they need more money. Could you pick that up again? I'm sorry, I took you off track for a second there.
And I think that's definitely one definitely point where we see that having or not having civilians as part of the defense ministry is definitely a drawback, because the military is traditionally been charged with doing what they can with what they get.
Yes.
Right. So if they get 100, that's what they know that they're gonna use.
Okay.
They call it a resource.
Yeah.
And once they get that resource, that's what they need to use.
Okay.
And they will not go and, I wouldn't say fight, because we've seen that in recent years there's been the military going back and saying, no, we do need this funding and fighting for that. But there's not the way to properly articulate this in a political arena and fight and obtain that required funding.
Yeah.
And also the response from the finance ministers have always been, why do you need a supersonic fighter? It costs $1 billion to set up a squadron. Forget about it. I need this money elsewhere.
Yeah.
Where the fundamental tools to provide defense and security are completely ignored.
Could you tell us a little bit about how procurement works in Mexico?
Sure. So usually procurement wise, the Army or the Air Force will settle on a requirement, will detect a necessity. Okay. From the necessity, they will begin to study options to fill that necessity, right? So, for instance, the clear necessity is the need to replace the old French armor. So then they set up a working group that begins to analyze options.
Okay.
And sometimes these options can be simply to modernize the current fleet, right? Or upgrade the current fleet. And another option is to go out and look in the international markets for potential options to replace this. Up to this date, however, I haven't seen a process that's attractive to international companies. The Sedena's procurement process becomes, even though it's transparent by law, when applied, it becomes difficult to understand. It becomes significantly difficult to understand, but it traditionally follows the federal government's procurement process. So they will select at least 3 options, and then those 3 options are requested to submit offers. Mm-hmm. They will submit an offer and a price point. And then Sedena will go to the finance ministry and say, these are the 3 options we have. Can you please fund any of them? And then that's where the finance ministry comes in and says, I can fund it, or I can only give you 90%, or I can only provide you 85%, or whatever, or there's no money for that.
Mm-hmm.
So then that project simply has to stand in line. And the secretary at that point begins to try to lobby somehow with the finance ministry so that the finance ministry could provide funding for it. At the end of the day, that's usually included in the budget. And the budget is approved by Congress. And there are two commissions in Congress that are supposed to oversee the budget.
Yeah.
But I sincerely doubt that they have the technical expertise to actually provide an assessment of what is needed. And that talks to us about the disconnect between the political class and the armed forces. While the armed forces may strive to have the congressmen understand what their needs are, mm-hmm. and they'll give them a tour of their bases, and they'll try to give them briefings.
Mm-hmm.
That congressman is there for 3 years, and that congressman then has its sights on either going in and becoming a mayor or a governor or a different cabinet level position. Therefore, there's not the appropriate expertise in Congress to do a serious oversight of the military.
But does that make Mexico any different from other countries? Because doesn't it work the same in, you know, the United States and Canada, that the actual parliamentarians who are authorizing are not experts on the subject?
No, but their staff are.
Uh-huh.
Or their staff commission independent reports or independent inquiries, independent studies.
Yeah.
Into what's taking place. Of course, a lot of congressmen throughout the world are definitely not experts in the military, but you see that a lot of the ones that are, for example, in the U.S. Armed Services Committee.
Yeah.
They'll make a career out of it, and they'll get in and they'll dig into it, and they'll be able to speak to what's going on, and so will their staff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they have specialized security clearance staff positions for that type of roles.
Mm-hmm. Accountability. How does accountability, financial accountability, work?
Yeah, you know, I've dug in, and I've been able to pull out a lot of information.
Mm.
Definitely, but it's all there. It's just really hard to find. You need to know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's frankly quite easy. But I've been doing this for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that the common citizen needs to be able to have the information provided in a much clearer way. At the end of the Calderon administration came out with a large amount of accountability reports.
Yeah.
With a huge amount of information as to procurement, as to deployments.
Yeah.
And that's one of that's one of the key problems that we sometimes have when we're analyzing. We've got there are countries that provide zero, or countries that provide 1,000 instead of 100.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you don't know what you're looking for, you get pretty much lost.
The last question I have for you is: what do you think about peacekeeping and Mexican participation?
I think it's been a fantastic opportunity. I think it's a great shift. I think that it's by far participation in peacekeeping will, frankly, long term, be one of the main drivers for change, not just for the armed forces, but for the government itself. Why? Because it's taking a completely different position on Mexico's foreign policy.
Right.
And finally burying that 18th century archaic probably not 18th or century, it was 19th, it was 20th century.
Sure, even 20th century,
The Estrada Doctrine.
Right.
And putting that, and burying that, frankly, because Mexico needs to be responsible for what happens around it and what happens in the world, and needs to be proactive. And the only way to do that is to engage globally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way that countries are used now to engage globally, you either do it as part of a military alliance,
mm-hmm.
or you do it as part of a broader multilateral organization such as the UN. Mexico's participation so far in that it's up to now it's around 26 or 28 observers deployed in 4 to 6 missions.
Yeah.
That's going to be growing gradually, and I think it's the result of so many years of looking inward,
mm-hmm.
that looking outward becomes hard, one, mm-hmm. and two, therefore they're making gradual steps. I do agree that, and I've heard so far that there's a peacekeeping operations training center in the making,
mm-hmm.
And for that they need to have some sort of doctrine and some sort of training and some sort of expertise, and that is going to be established sometime before 2018.
Okay.
With the future point of having at least the battalion ready to be deployed by 2020.
Okay.
The exact composition of that battalion is not yet clear.
Uh-huh.
They believe, the armed forces believe, that having a joint battalion may be a good idea.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I personally believe that if we look at the our Chilean and Argentine Cruz del Sur, Southern Cross peacekeeping force, that gives us a pretty good model of how to integrate two different armed forces. And by two different armed forces, in this case, I mean SEDENA and SEMAR,
mm-hmm.
Into a single operations force.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. From that, I believe that experience throughout the globe will also help the military look beyond its internal policing role.
Okay.
And that may, you know, because people that join the military, as romantic as it sounds, they want to go and fight wars. They don't want to go and tell their grandchildren about the day that they took Juarez.
Right.
Or the day that they took Reynosa. That's nonsense.
Okay.
They, you know, when you...
They want to say they went to Kosovo.
Yeah.
No, right.
Or Congo,
yeah.
And they fought a militia. They saved the village.
Okay. Okay, Inigo. Well, I mean, that's all the time. We've taken way too much of your time, over an hour now. So thank you for being on the Security Perimeter podcast. And we'll speak to you again soon, maybe after this peacekeeping battalion has been established and is functioning, and maybe we can take up the issue of the lessons Mexico has learned from its peacekeeping experiences in the last year and the coming 2 years.
Thank you, Zaki. Like I said, thank you so much for having me on Security Perimeter, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Okay. Take care, my friend.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.